So it's good we had more light, because the title of the talk tonight is A Little Lightness Goes a Long Way. And lightness here is a little different from physical light. It actually means lightness of the self, or lightness of our presence in life. So there's a very nice Sanskrit and Pali expression called ahamkara. And ahamkara means the tendency for every being that is born in a body to have some kind of me in there. So everything, every ant, every coronavirus is going to say, I'm here, a little bit, okay? And humans big time. But it's a nice understanding that just being born in a body, part of that is we collect around inside the body a kind of center called me, in order to protect this body and look after it. And life makes selves and needs it. You could say, we talked about this before, that self is a kind of a operating system of the being. Kind of Windows of the computer is like the me inside the person. But we turned, as humans, we turned this operating system into quite a big, sometimes monster, but certainly something really big. And out of context of what it's needed, we don't need such a big self to get on in life. And the story that illustrates this, and I've said this before, so those of you who've been hearing talks on self and anatta by me are going to know this story, but I'll say it again, about the man with the suit. It's a lovely story. It's a guy goes to a tailor and says, make me a suit. And the tailor says, sure. Measures him and says, come back in 2 weeks, it'll be ready. Comes back in 2 weeks, puts on the jacket, and one sleeve is longer than the other. He says, the jacket doesn't fit. So the tailor says, well, if you walk like this, then everything will be fine. And then the buttons are not lined up. And the tailor says, it doesn't matter. If you walk like that, then it'll be all right. And the trousers don't fit. The crotch is too tight. And then they're not the same length. Doesn't matter. If you walk like this, everything will be okay. So he goes out into the street with this suit. And and there was two people sitting on a bench in the park. And one says, oh, this poor cripple. And the other one says, yeah, but he's got a lovely suit. And that's our self. It's such a beautiful story, because we try and fit ourselves into a self, and we call ourselves an accountant, or a grandfather, or a moneymaker, or a whatever, or just a person. And we fit ourselves into the suit that doesn't fit us exactly. It's tight. That's the self. It's livush. It's the set of clothes. And it's one of the attachments. So we feel ourselves inside the suit, and we're not quite sure how to take it off. So the four great attachments in the Buddhist teaching, this is perhaps the biggest of them, attachment to self. Another is attachment to senses, what I like, what I don't like. A third is attachment to views and opinions and what I think to be, as being true, and what I believe as being true, etc., etc. Attachment to views. And the fourth is attachment to rituals, practices, retreats, but having things in a certain way and calling them holy. So they're the four great attachments in the Buddhist tradition. And what's important, and I'm very happy that someone brought this up today in one of the meetings, the personal meetings, is that the way to work with attachment is not to fight it. So we don't fight the self in order to kind of get unattached from it, but we don't feed it. And the word for attachment in the Pali language is upadana, and upadana means nutrition. So we don't feed the attachments, we don't attack them, but we don't feed them, and instead we feed freedom. And that's something very respectful about the Buddhist path. It's, you know, many, many aspects of the Buddhist path have really kept me personally in this path most of my life. And I've been in like every other kind of trip, spiritual journey. But I come back to the Dharma because of things like this that are so fine and so beautiful. You don't fight for your freedom. You just don't feed what imprisons you. You don't fight, you don't attack, because it just makes it stronger. So what we're doing here, one of the ways of not feeding the attachment to self is really to look at the way self arises inside experience. And here it's simply honesty, clarity, that we look at experience and we see where, what really is happening. And all the attachments begin to dissolve if we look directly at them at eye level and look at the way they arise and look at the way we build them and look at the difficulties that we experience, the dukkha inside them, etc. But the direct seeing rather than attacking. And here, the experience shows us the self because it's dualistic. So we look at anything and we see an object. And we are a subject looking at an object. And there is a subject looking or knowing and the known. If we examine that inside our experience, we begin to see how the self, the subject, is there, but we begin to understand that the whole thing comes together, the knower, the knowing, and the known are needing each other. So right now, we can say, you all are looking and listening, unless you fell asleep, at this object here. So all of you have, to some extent, a place from which you're looking at, a sense of location, mikum, a sense of center, and looking at. The looking is the knowing, and the object is this that you're looking at. But if you look at it a bit more carefully, the whole thing is one. It's all happening together. You can't do that if the object wasn't here. If I'm not here, there wouldn't be an object. It needs me as an object to create you as a subject. It needs you as a subject to create me as an object. It needs the knowing to be there so that the whole thing happens. Everything is depending on everything else. And if you look at that carefully, you'll see that, you know, that life isn't made of boxes. And so there is the sense of the clarity of subject, we need to see that, and the clarity of the interdependence of everything, that everything is built of everything else. We make the world as we go along. It may seem difficult to grasp, but there is, if we look carefully, it's not just quantum physics that says that. It's quantum Buddha that says that. That because there is light, the eye is made in order to see light. Because there is light, there is an eye. Because there's a flower, there's a bee. Because there is, no, endlessly, because there is the earth, there is a flower. Because there's no end. You can't go, you can't put it in boxes. Everything is creating everything else. So we are creating the tree that we see. The tree is there as part of our world. And the whole world is made such that we can see a tree. And we can play with this experience, which is really interesting for us. We play with this experience of subject-object in meditation. For example, samadhi, deep samadhi means deep absorption into an object of meditation. We actually disappear. We dive into the object, such as the breath, and maybe you've experienced this. There's just breathing happening and there's no breather anymore. That's samadhi. That's a very sort of strong samadhi. So the subject can disappear. The object can also disappear. When we just sort of, many different situations where we just feel light or space, or there's no special object to see, or we feel we are locked in ourselves and we don't notice the world. So we're fully subject. You know that Zen phrase, first there is the person looking at the mountain, then there is just the mountain, then there is just the person, I forget how it works, and then there is neither the mountain nor the person, and then there's the mountain and the person again. It's kind of a processes of undoing the duality which we experience in meditation practice. And it can be a little scary because we're so used to a self. Joseph Goldstein once said that understanding the non-self nature of things, understanding the interrelation of everything, creates a sense that there's no ground. Because if everything is interrelated, where can I stand? Where's the ground? And he said it's a bit like someone falling out of the plane without a parachute, which is really scary until you realize that there's no ground. So then it doesn't matter anymore. You're just flying. I was talking about this with Rachel, my wife, half an hour ago, and I seem to remember something she said, because I'm getting a lot of teaching of this. There's reflections, in a way, in every spiritual path, so I get the Kabbalah version. And she said, in the Aramaic, the divine is loads of different descriptions of the divine, and one of them is stima distimin, which in Aramaic means two things, satum totally, legamre satum means you can't go there, you can't see God, but it's also stam, it has both together. And stam is a beautiful Hebrew word for just what what it is that we're talking about, the Dharma of that. It's just that. Stam is a lovely word, and it really, and the Aramaic goes there and calls it, in a way, the name of God. So sometimes we can simply decide not to be interested in this duality. When something turns up, a difficult thought, we have the power to say, no, thank you. Very dualistic. It and me makes me the victim of some difficult thought or memory. And we can say, no, I am with the world. I don't need this thing dominating my consciousness, for example, or somebody else. I don't need this. And there's a nice little story about that in the text, where the Buddha said, what happens if you get a parcel from Amazon at the door? Someone knocks at the door and brings you a parcel. I'm just talking about Amazon. But this is 2,500 years ago. The Amazon of 2,500 years ago. Someone comes and brings you a parcel and you say, no, thank you. What happens to the parcel? It stays with the person. It doesn't come to you. It stays where it came from. And there's a lot of encouragement to say, you know, to say, no, I don't need that. And it just stays where it came from. So sometimes we can do that with dualism. And we can say, I don't need to have two sides to an experience. I want to see the whole. I want to be in the whole. I don't want this habit of subject-object. And there's loads of, and in a way we're doing it. I'll ask you to do a small exercise that Rupert Spira, who's got loads and loads of wonderful exercises that he teaches, is one that he does. So put your hands on your two knees, separate from each other. And pay attention to one hand only. And now feel that your attention is moving to the other hand. Maybe you can move it back, if you like, to the first hand. So the question is, what is the attention moving through? What's the medium? That the attention is moving, swimming through when it goes from one hand to the other. It goes through what? And here's an example of attention going into space rather than into objects. Can we pay attention to the space in this room? Or is our attention totally captivated by us, people, objects? Or can we get a sense that there's space in this room? Can we get a sense there's light in this room? Or can we only see the light coming from the walls and the people and everything? But there's light in this room that we don't see. We see it's when it lands on something. There are places where there's just awareness, not locked into objects, between things. Between thoughts. What's between two thoughts? What about the gaps between things? When we move our attention from one place to another, what's the gap? What's between us and the tree, actually, when we're looking at a tree? What's between? What joins the tree and us? So there's a lot of mystery in all of that. It's not obvious because we're so used to seeing two sides of an experience, subject, object. That's where our mind goes so automatically. It's not easy to see differently from that, but it's possible, not so difficult. There's a lot of practice in the Dharma about going out of our usual boundaries. There's one place where we can practice, which is, you can call it the big mind. Maybe we'll do this tomorrow as an exercise. Just going out of the boundary of this body, that the consciousness isn't in the limit of the body, but opens out. We did a lot of research on boundarylessness states, university research, and I was originally the subject, put in all kinds of machines at the Bar Ilan and the University of Haifa and all that, testing on me experiences of boundarylessness, of having no boundary, and how, where in the brain that happens, that no self, just no boundary. And then actually I took 30 people through a course. I think it was November of last year, of experiences of no boundary, and then they were put in the machines as well. And we have a paper, a scientific paper, another one on that. So we can be playful. One thing that meditation is, we shouldn't take meditation as being too heavy. We can be playful with our consciousness. And I really recommend being playful, being trying things out. Don't get too stuck on one method. Look and see what happens. Do I need the boundaries? Is my consciousness limited, really? What happens when I try and look there? Where am I? Where is my limits really? Isn't just a habit to say my limit is here? So if it's just a habit, what's not the habit? Play with awareness. It's a very big subject, and there are many, many, many non-dual teachers, especially Advaita teachers, Papaji, Ramana Maharshi, Nisargadatta Maharaj, and many, many more from the Indian tradition, who go into a place of practice of the sense of meeting the subtle self, the point of view of me, and constantly challenging it. Where is it? How is it? What is it? When is it? And staying with this sense of me as the observer. Because when you stay with something, it begins to dissolve, it changes, you see. Nothing stays. You look at the self and it cannot stay what it is. It moves, it's dynamic. And we begin to see through it. We see how transparent it is. a lot of the, I would say, the ground in the Dharma, the helpfulness of a retreat, the sense of community, the kindness here, the good food that these the wonderful kitchen folk are making for us, I mean, all kinds of things supporting something basically healthy in this community so that we can be free and go beyond the boundaries. One of the places in which help us go beyond the usual boundaries is a sense of trust. And trust allows us to go to places that we don't usually go to, that we are scared. And it's also important that what we're talking about here is not radical, drastic, immediate, like a kaze fireworks. It has to be done in a healthy way. And sometimes it happens that it's a non-self is a kind of inner explosion, pitutz pnimi, and then people sometimes spend years trying to put themselves back together again because it was all too strong, too fast. So again, the Dharma has a very is very full of protections. So the stretching of the boundaries of awareness and the meeting of the self and dissolving the self happens slowly and steadily in the right way, along with other powers such as trust, such as care and kindness, and such as joy. That this whole thing is a healthy spiritual growth rather than a dramatic, super intensive explosion of the self. So what happens if there is less self? What are the signs? What sort of hints are there then if we feel less of a self, less dominating by the self? One of the places that we might notice or feel or be aware of as practice, but also as experience, is something about our sources, our makorot, something about our deeper place. And the image I have is like in a tap, there's water. But all that water from every tap, loads and loads of taps are coming from water that's underground in the aquifer. Our aquifer is the consciousness. And then it appears in all these different forms and shapes and all the time different. But what's the source of it all is our awareness, our consciousness. And we begin to be more interested in that, just like I said, like the space in the room. You think, well, it's not that interesting, the space in the room. Why should I look at the space in the room? If I told you that awakening enlightenment is actually very boring, it's like the space in the room. But it makes a huge change in the way we are. We talked about filters before. So with no filters, we'll see the space in the room as important as the objects. And then there is that sense of the totality. So our consciousness coming from underneath, our consciousness giving birth to forms and to shapes, like the sky. And in front of the sky, there's clouds. The consciousness is like the sky. Awareness like the sky and clouds appearing. And it's very much Tibetan image. Consciousness as mother, as the womb, giving birth to form. So are we only interested in the form, or we want to actually connect with the womb as well? The source, the mother. Not just the babies. So one of the signs of, talk about a few directions of what we might notice. One of them is this sense of lightness. And I'm talking about things that we might notice if we have a little bit more freedom around the self, that we take the self a little bit more lightly. Doesn't mean going to the huge kind of ultimate non-dual realization. I'm talking about less self-importance, less self-centered, more connecting to awareness, less fixed, less attachment, but a bit. But we can find quite easily that we're more light in our life. That we're not to take everything becomes a drama. And that's not so difficult. I mean, so many people after retreats would still say, oh, life is a problem and I get struggle and so on and so on. But it's true that I don't turn everything into such a drama as I used to before the retreats. And lightness is one of the places that we'll notice. We're dancing more with change, with what we cannot control, rather than struggling constantly against it. Whatever happens, we get gifts or we get challenges, wounded in life. In either case, there's something a bit lighter in the way we receive the unexpected. So that's something that we can recognize and pay attention to in life. When we leave this retreat, pay attention. Maybe a little bit. We're just not as heavy with things as we were. We can take things a little bit more lightly, whatever it is. Another place that is, if you like, a sign or an interest is the senses. Because the senses are very clean. The senses, hearing, looking, seeing. And we're live, the more we are in senses, the more we are connected to Eros, to the juice of life, to the sensory field, which is full of aliveness. So we may naturally feel, and you know, all of us in a way I think can understand this, we're more interested in, I know that in a retreat itself, we experience this, people can spend 15 minutes watching the ants. And when someone asks you, what did you do in the retreat? Well, I spent 15 minutes watching ants. So they say, straight to mental hospital. But we become more aware through the senses. There's more beauty in life. We'll feel a little bit more sensitive, open. We see more that we usually don't see. We notice the small flowers next to the path on the way out to our car. We notice more because the senses are more alive, because there's less me, a little bit less me, having to process everything. And there'll be lots more silence. We'll love silence more. We will feel more silence. And even in the middle of noise, we'll feel more silence. A bit, maybe. But the Buddha said, the Buddha's name was Muni. Muni means the silent one. And someone came to him and said, but you know, you don't stop talking for 5 minutes. And he said, yeah, I talk a lot, but I'm always silent inside. And we can sense there's a silence inside there, and more silence in life for us. We had a session the other day in Mashiv Nefesh because the Israel Air Force really decided that Kliel was a wonderful place to try out their F-15. And they were really low and making such a noise. And if you can imagine what's happening with a group of people meditating and these planes, and every 5 minutes, another one, another one, another one, another one. And in the nature, in the quiet of Kliel. And we worked on it. You know, what is happening really? Where is the power to hear noise as noise? Or do we turn it into something totally disturbing, totally unpleasant, totally impossible, totally terrible? By the way, funny story, it's just aside. 20 years ago, this was also happening, I remember. And then we had someone that started to come every week to sessions at Mashiv Nefesh in Kliel. And after a few months, he said, "You don't know, but I used to be a pilot of an F-15 that used to go over Kliel all the time, making a big noise. And now I'm under, meditating with you." So, silence, sense of lightness, sense of less, a little bit more dancing with change, ability to flow with things, less heaviness, less drama, and the title of the talk, "A little lightness goes a long way." It makes quite a lot of difference, even if we are just a bit aware of all of this. We don't have to go all the way. A little bit of a sense of, okay, I can cope with that challenge. There's something different. Let it come, let it go. Our power to let things go, our power to be a little more freer with content of consciousness and of our life, a little bit more lightness, and we'll find that there's a different relationship to the challenges of daily life. Our boss, our partner, our children, our parents, our politicians are still going to do what they're going to do. But somewhere in us, we're a little bit more ready just to flow, not to shut them out, but not to let them in all the way and be destroyed by them. The sense of lightness inside, space inside, where you receive the world. Someone can come and give us a really hard time, but it doesn't build in us more stories and more dramas and more stories and more dramas, because there's more space. And that space is a sense of less me, less tightness of me. It goes to equanimity. Equanimity is perhaps the number one quality that is an expression of the awakened mind, or of the journey to the awakened mind. It's the seventh of the seven factors of awakening. It's the fourth of the four Brahma Viharas. It's the tenth of the ten paramis. It's like the kind of, it's like the final quality that is built through all these practices is equanimity. And equanimity is not about Shirion having armor and not allowing. It's not about having a Teflon consciousness that just doesn't allow things in. It's allowing the world, it's listening to the world, it's being aware of the pain of the world, like the Buddha with his big ears. But the pain of the world doesn't destroy us, because there's enough inner space to be there right in the heart of the difficulties of the world But we're okay because there's enough space to accommodate. We can't do it if there's too much self. We will be struggling. Everything will hurt us too much. We'll be fighting all the time. The Buddha said, I don't dispute with the world. I don't fight with the world, but the world disputes with me. In other words, yes, the world does things to me, but I don't fight with the world. And one thing I want to talk about now to finish this talk is action. So how do we act from that place? And when we act from a place that is less personal and less self, firstly, we will just be less interested in success or failure. It will not dominate. I said this before, that one of the keys that that helped me to give Dhamma talks like now is something I heard 30 years ago from a teacher in California who said, to be a teacher of Dharma is not about giving the best talk, the most charismatic and wonderful talk. It's if you give the worst talk you ever gave in your life, you get up from the Bama and you don't have one thought about it. Less sense of ambition, less sense of measuring, less sense of blame if it doesn't work, or less sense of pride if it does work. Or it's about not having the self as the judge all the time and having a commenting on the side saying, you did it, you didn't do it, well done, nice, not nice, this. Instead of that, there is the sense that the action is coming from that source that I talked about, the underground water, the aquifer. The action comes from inside, and you're giving your action to the world. And that's all you can do and all you need to do. You give your qualities to the world, and that's it. Karma will look after the rest, not up to you. And it saves you so much pain of measuring and judging. I want to do it better, I want to do it more. There's enough energy in the giving of yourself to the world. You don't need to add to it pressure from having to be the best. It's enough just to give dana, your life as dana. I'm giving the best I can. And actually, then, if you want to do better in life, you develop qualities which are more developed, qualities of compassion, of kindness, of attention, of sensitivity, of steadiness. And these qualities are what you give to the world, whether it's political action or social action or action as a parent or a teacher or whatever. You give these qualities, and if you want to do better, develop these qualities even more and give them out into the world. But the measuring, the judging, and the success and failure don't help that much. You need a little bit to know if you're going, you know, left or right. But even that, how do you know to choose? The more self, the more painful it is to make any choices. And if you're less selfing, you will know what's right because you are with the world. As I said before, I think it was the last talk, when there's less me in the middle, it's not that you get sort of into nothing. What happens is you're simply more connected to the whole world. The whole world comes instead of the self, instead of the subject, the busyness with subject and object. The world comes in. And you say you're coming from a world point of view. There's the world looking out of your eyes, not just a me. And that means you can choose in life so much more easy because you're with the world. So the world, and you say, go there. It's not all up to you to try and work out what's better for me. Anyway, we don't know. And it's so much headache. But if you're connected to the world is working through you, the choice is happening by itself. It's fitting to go left and not right. It's fitting to go to Kfar Yassif today. Why? That's fitting. Here I am. Choices, in a way, happen to us. Actually, neurology shows that. There's lots of scientific studies on the brain that shows that we make choices before we think that we're making the choice. The brain makes a choice, and then we say, I'm choosing left or choosing right. It reminds me of that story of the little prince, where the king is on a star and says, I command you to stand up. And the little prince says, well, I am standing. So the king said, you see, it worked. That's why I'm the king. So another aspect of action from that place is that it feels much less of a doing, much less. There's non-action inside action. There's much less of a sense of doing. There's much more things are happening by themselves. And it's quite a liberating experience. In the groups we have in the evening with those in the service retreat, we talk about this every service retreat, this sense of service, action, cooking, and how mindfulness and mindful awareness can help us to sense it's actually not in the end me that has to produce this wonderful meal for all the yogis. There's this little bit more relaxation. It's happening by itself. So I want to read a piece about this, which is from my new book, which isn't out yet. It's being edited. It'll come out in Hebrew. And this is towards the end of the book. The book itself is about my story, really, of how I built my house with the stones many years ago. And I kind of weaved in these kind of teachings into the book of building and building with stones. So I just want to read a piece, which is a reflective piece about exactly this. What is it that constructs a wall from a random pile of stones? Or indeed, builds a thought from the raw material of primal awareness, its intention? The rest happens accordingly. Reality is a cloud of indeterminacy. Indeterminacy, you know, not determined. It's pure potential. Human intention collapses it and forces it to be born as something, such as a wall, or as quantum physics says, a subatomic particle. What we want and what we define makes worlds. We sing the world into existence. But what if there's no intention? Would it all stop? Could the building that I'm doing carry on without it? If the human observer went home for lunch, does the subatomic particle return to the womb from which it was born? Could the wall be unmade if all interventions and definitions of it stopped? I tried it. I surrendered out of experience into a timeless, trackless, and undefined moment. the touch of stone became just bubbling energy without location. Stone, hand, touch, and the person running the show all disappeared as definable things. But the wall didn't collapse into a pile of dust. Yet with this awareness, it ceased to be a knowable object. It became a glorious uncertainty. The word wall didn't make any sense anymore. But was it possible to build this way? From a regular conventional point of view, no. But from this awakened point of view, the question turned round. Was it possible to build any other way? Building without the constant sense of something to be done was radically different. It is zooming in to the carrying, the placing, and the movements of the body and mind, and showed that they were all just happening by themselves. And if I zoomed out to take in the big picture, the stones, the trees, all the mass of creatures and people living their life, it brought me to the same place. No one in charge. The builder was a person-sized point of view, one of many. If the building could be seen as happening by itself, then how can the builder say that he is the builder? How could the wall itself say that it is being built? So if I'm not really the builder, then I'm also not really a person, or a human being, or anything definable, beyond conventions and points of view. The words appearing on this white page, the thoughts that are just twinkles of light behind them, this person writing these words, you, the reader, are no more than convenient fictions. I felt launched into free fall, and it was scary. Despite the mass of the rock in my hands, where could any real ground be found? So we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.